Hello, welcome to ITE 1, Chapter 2, Part 2 for Semester 1 of 2011. I will just quickly say I will quickly let people know I'm expecting a brief call from someone to let me know that he's safe from at the airport. I will probably take about 2 minutes to do that. If that comes in, I already promised him I'd call, or I would take his call, and then I realized, oh, I have lecture, so it'll just be, hey, how you doing?
Grace has got your notes.
Yeah, I've got your notes.
She'll just pick up and carry on.
I'll just pick up where you left off, and you'll be fine.
All right, cool. I just thought I'd let people know. So where I have, hang on a second, I have a cough. That's better. Where I have left off is, where I remember was electromagnetic interference. That's where we'll pick up. Before we get started, does anyone have any questions on labs or any outstanding questions you might have about anything?
Can I just make a suggestion? Very quick suggestion. If people want to look at the labs, like if they're all finished everything and they're just like sitting around spinning their wheels, feel free to work ahead where possible. Obviously, if you come across something that you don't understand, you'll have to wait for the lecture, but there was a set of lectures given last semester, and if you work ahead, you'll find Chapter 5 and 6 far less stressful. So just a thought. That's if you happen to have spare time and you feel like doing CAVI.
That is very true. Because those chapters have a lot of labs. Great work coming in, guys. Labs are rolling in. Very nice. All right. So let's...
Yeah, everybody's doing a really good job with submitting labs.
Yeah. It's very great stuff. Alrighty. Electromagnetic interference, or EMI, is the intrusion of outside electromagnetic signals in a transmission media, such as copper cabling. In a network environment, EMI distorts the signals so that the receiving devices have difficulty interpreting them. There are many sources of EMI. They can be man-made, such as motors or power lines, or natural, such as electrical storms or solar radiation. Oh yeah, I think we did do part of this, but that's okay. Wireless networks are affected by radio frequency interference, or RFI, not to be confused with RFI, the fun addictive iPod game. RFI. RFI is
That's
interference
awesome.
Caused by radio. We did it last time, so I thought I'd mention it. RFI is the interference caused by... Yeah, we commented on how similar they were last term, so... This is the interference caused by radio transmitters and other devices transmitting in the same frequency. For example, a cordless telephone can cause problems with a wireless network when both devices use the same frequency. So do you ever wonder why the 2.4 gigahertz cordless phones went out of style? Yeah, this is part of why. And also microwaves can cause interference when positioned in close proximity to wireless networking devices. Now, if I had been prepared, I was going to record a demo of me being in front of my microwave with my wireless computer headset and microwaving something, because that sounds very interesting. By the time I remembered, there were too many people here, and I didn't want them to think I was absolutely crazy for talking in front of the microwave. But I will try and do that another time when we talk about this again. But Grace will tell you, it's a very interesting sound. You've been on a couple of those Skype calls, haven't you?
Oh, all yeah, right. Absolutely. It gets all weird and blippy and strange.
Kind of rattly and, yeah, it's interesting.
And the emphasis should be placed on motors as well, because treadmills will even cause that.
Oh, I guess so.
Which ones?
Treadmills.
Treadmills.
Yeah, you mentioned that. Somebody's treadmill was causing problems. That's right. Okay, this can also cause problems with wireless audio devices, like we were just saying. Climate can also affect computer components. This is very testable material, so they're very particular about climate on these tests. If it is very dry, there is more chance of ESD, electrostatic discharge. If it is too warm, components may overheat. Overheating in anything is not good. If it is too humid, components may be damaged by moisture. So this is why we don't do what someone I know did and put their laptop in the bathroom while they're having a shower and listen to music on it. I about flip my lid when I found out that they did that. I happened to live with them at the time.
My boyfriend, who was a computer... ex-boyfriend who was a computer technician, used to bring his laptop into the bathroom to listen to baseball. And then he wondered why his fingerprint reader stopped working.
Wow. Yeah. He should have gotten an FM transmitter. All right, now we will review electrical concepts. And this is the fun part for me. These are confusing for me, but here we go.
That's okay. You've got computers a ham, and you've got me, and you've got about three other people that know electrical concepts. So. Yep.
Okay, here we go. Computers need both voltage and current to operate. So, could someone define voltage for me?
Voltage is also known as electromotive force. Oh, I'm not supposed to be doing it. Anyway,
yeah.
An electromotive force is the pressure that is applied to electrons forcing them through a circuit. I promise I will not do the next one.
Carries on anyway.
Okay. I've already said that it was EMF. Yeah. I mean, I might as well just get on with
you're
it.
Right.
I mean, you know.
So, yeah.
So does somebody want
force
to?
That moves electrons through a circuit. So.
Does anyone want to tell us what current is? That isn't carrying.
Resistance, isn't it?
No.
No, that's different.
Amount of electrodes going through through there.
That's okay.
The amount of electrons that the voltage is pushing through.
That's right.
That's right. An ampere is actually defined as a coulomb of electrons per second. But that's just not important.
These are not in your test.
Now, I find all that stuff interesting that you do, those little extra things. It helps me remember.
Absolutely.
Well, that's good. Okay, so we've described what current is. And that's good. When voltage is not steady, this part is kind of testable. Well, is very testable when it comes a little bit further on. When voltage is not steady, computers have trouble operating and can suffer permanent damage. And those of you will know about this from lightning strikes and stuff. Here is a list of the various power fluctuations that can occur. And these are in your test several times, especially, well, they used to be on the final up there now.
No,
here we go. Blackouts. Blackout is a complete loss of AC power. Okay. That's good to know. A blown fuse, damaged transformer, or downed power line can cause a blackout. And that's just what you'd think. All the lights go out and everything turns off. That's how I remember. A brownout is a reduced voltage level of AC power that lasts for a period of time. Brownouts occur when the power line voltage drops below 80% of the normal voltage level. Overloading electrical circuits can cause a brownout. Noise. Noise is interference from generators and lightning. Noise results in unclean power, which can cause errors in a computer system. That just doesn't even sound like something you want. Spike. This is very important. It's a sudden increase in voltage that lasts for a very short period and exceeds 100% of the normal voltage on a line. So that's when it goes zipping way higher than it's supposed to, and it's very quick, very fast. Spikes can be caused by lightning strikes, but can also occur when the electrical system comes back after a blackout. So now everything comes back on, and whoa, it goes crazy. Power surge. Power surge is a dramatic increase in voltage above the normal flow of electrical current. A power surge lasts for a few nanoseconds, and a nanosecond is 1/1,000,000,000 of a second. So spikes and surges are easily confused. The difference is that spikes are sudden increases over 100% of the normal voltage, so that's when it goes up way higher than it's supposed to. And surges are usually due to fluctuations from the power company, is what I have here. Surges are a little bit longer, not that you'd really notice that much, because they're both short enough to cause problems. So there are several devices that protect computers and their components from these nasty power things that we don't want. Did you have anything to add, Grace, on those, or did I get it right?
I was just going to say, so spike, lightning, surge, power company, and it's a little bit longer.
Also,
yeah, spikes are sudden, and that's the way I used to remember it, because they kind of worded it similar, close
to that. Also, if you're interested in the stuff that we're about to talk about in a minute on uninterruptible power supplies, may I refer you to the list archives for last week or the week before for Cavi Discuss, where an excellent discussion of uninterruptible power supplies was posted.
Yes, it was good. Someone says in chat that they forgot one. What do you think they might have forgotten?
What did we forget?
Sags.
There's a power condition where when you have a neat thing like if someone turns on the air conditioning, you get, it's not quite a brownout because it's very short in duration, but a big load will cause a drop, and it's, excuse me, a couple of seconds. Last term, they had a term for that. It was like a...
Sag?
Sag.
It's a sag.
Yeah, it's a sag.
Kind of the opposite. Sag was the thing that was in the test that didn't exist, wasn't it?
No, brownout
doesn't
exist.
No, I think it did exist, but they didn't really...
They didn't talk about it.
Elaborate on it. That's what it was. It was one of the terms they put in, and they weren't nice enough to describe. But now
back
we know
when
what
I did ITE 1 version of 3.1, they talked about sags, and a sag was a voltage drop of under 90% of the supply voltage for time. For a reasonable amount of time, such as Brian's talking about, you turning the air conditioner on, or you know, 100 volts or whatever, depending on where you are, and that's where it sort of dips out the power. It's sort of where you find that all the lights go dim and stuff. And I believe it's
sometimes people.
To
yeah,
as
I was going
to
say, some people will notice. They'll say, "Oh my gosh, the lights just got dimmer for a second and then brighter again." It's probably a sag they were noticing. I would think.
It's sort of the
opposite.
Well,
just kind of like, really?
We're going to call it a sag, and maybe a sag doesn't exist, but we're going to pretend it does. We're going to
that's what
we're going to call it. But if you can find the proper name for it, we will stand corrected. How's that?
Okay, so we're going to talk about the wibble. We're going to talk about the devices that protect us from power problems. The first one is a surge suppressor, and it helps protect against damage from surges and spikes. A surge suppressor diverts extra electrical voltage on the line to the ground. Not all power strips or power boards have surge suppression or protection capabilities. Some are only strips with multiple outlets, and this is especially true in Australia and places that use 220 to 240 because they're a lot more expensive to make surge equipment that can protect against that kind of surge. And it used to be power strips with no surge was more common here quite a few years ago, 10, 15 years ago. But that seems to be now pretty much anyone you buy here from Walmart or Best Buy or whatever has. But be careful because it might not. It'll be the one time when you think it should.
The other thing is that surge suppressors may protect you from surges, but you're going to need a very good surge suppressor to protect you from spikes, because spikes are like, 10 million volts for a nanosecond. And you need a very good gas tube and stuff to actually do that. And there is actually a company over here that does sell power boards that will do it, and that will give you, a higher level of protection against those sorts of occurrences. But you will pay for it.
Remember that the ones you buy from Walmart for $10, they're worth $10. How good do you think that the tubes in those are going to be? I would not trust the $10 Walmart special. I would get maybe a Belkin or something that's a little more expensive, but you won't have to worry about the the surges as much.
Belkin provide on certain power protection products, and you'd have to look at their website, they actually provide a guarantee of equipment protection. If things are connected to that power board, they will actually guarantee the value of that equipment. So whilst your computer may go bang and pour smoke, they will actually give you money for that computer because they reckoned it should have been protected. However, it is things that are connected directly to the Belkin power board, not six levels of power board down, four double adapters and a partridge in a pear tree.
That doesn't even sound smart. Some of the Belkin ones are, some of the new adapters are cool, or surges are cool, because they have provisions for the giant power wall wart AC adapter monstrosities that are everywhere now. There was even one that had like little tentacles that came off of it with a little outlet on each one. I remember
that's
reading about
cool.
that. I thought, oh, that's cool, and I want one.
Now remember, multiple power strips put together can equal fire hazard. So as long as you know that.
Yeah, they don't actually mention that here, but that is a good thing that we want to prevent fire hazards. So that's a good one. The next device is an uninterruptible.
I was going to say, don't the surge suppressors frequently have like a guarantee, like maybe, you know, 2 years, 3 years, 4 years, 5 years, and then change them out after time?
Yes, because over time the gas will. Yeah, go ahead, Brian. Sorry.
Oh, I'll let him finish.
Oh, it was me. No, he did finish. I was just saying that there is actually a situation where as if the surge suppressor handles too many spikes or surges, it can actually tire the gas in the tube, and it will then lose its ability to absorb the excess energy. Okay, go ahead.
All right. The next device is the uninterruptible
No. Brian had something to say.
Oh, you're talking to him. I'm sorry.
Yeah,
I forgot.
Brian, go ahead. Brian Shaw, sorry, it is now your turn. And then you can have it back, Sean, I promise.
Sorry.
Yeah, I was going to say, even if you connect multiple power strips into one, there's no guarantee that you're going to get the power that you need through there. I've actually seen that happen to where there was one power strip that had like six different ones running off of it, and you couldn't run anything on them because the power just wasn't there.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah, the other thing you can find is that if you start sticking power strips together and stuff, you can also see cases where the load is unevenly distributed and you can have all sorts of problems. Okay, it's all yours, Sean.
Yeah,
give it all you got.
All right, uninterruptible power supply, or UPS, and we have probably heard about these in our computing travels around. The UPS helps us against potential electrical power problems by supplying electrical power to a computer or other device. It supplies electrical power to a computer or other device, and there's a battery inside which is constantly recharging while the UPS is in use. The UPS is able to provide a consistent quality of power when brownouts and blackouts occur. Many UPS devices are able to communicate directly with the operating system on a computer. This communication allows the UPS to safely shut down the computer and save data prior to the UPS losing all electrical power. I'd like to see this, because I've never seen this.
I should do an audio demo of it happening. I should do that at home, because I've got Linux servers that will then scream shutdown messages and go, power bad,
cool.
Shutting down now.
Yeah, that would be kind of cool.
There is one in the main menu of that.
Oh!
At the office
there's
where
one
I
where?
Work, Oh, go ahead. I'll make my comment in a second.
Sorry, I was saying I believe there's one, and there's a main menu demo of one of those power supply things. I'm not sure if it actually demos it shutting down, but it mentions how it connects, pops up in the system tray and stuff. And gives you about 10 minutes, and then it shuts down.
Cool.
Okay. I was going to do one on Linux because it's sort of more interesting, and it can sort of gabble shutdown messages, and I can actually check battery voltages and make it really, you know, geeky.
Hey, you could still do that. That'd be cool.
Yeah, we could have both.
The high school version.
Never
and then you'll get all Carrie's crazy comments.
Yes.
Sorry,
never
if you could afford it.
Never plug a printer into a UPS.
Sorry, go ahead, Maria.
Sorry, yeah, if you could afford it, would you have your surge protection power board and a UPS?
Most UPSs include surge protection as part of them. And I would strongly recommend, especially for where you live, that if you ever get to it, save up and spend the $80 to $120, maybe some more dollars on a UPS for your important power gear so that it doesn't sizzle, because the power grid up there is really exciting.
I've got a surge protector already, and it seems to run pretty well, but yeah, I'm thinking of a UPS.
It's peace of mind. It also means that if you're broadcasting or whatever and the power goes out, you go, look, guys, I'm going off the air. I've got like 5 minutes before it's, you know, down and down. I'll, you know, let you know when I'm all back or whatever. It just gives you a bit of peace of mind. It also means that if you're in the middle of working on one of those big, long Cavi labs and you lose the power and you're not using a laptop, it's not all gone. And that's always good, too.
Yeah, that's true.
Okay. Never plug a printer into a UPS because printers can overload them. And this is especially true with laser printers because they're very high draw. And that's, we don't want that because we actually want your UPS to work when problems happen. And we want it to be there for you. These devices use DC power to store charge, which must then be converted back into AC power, because this is what the power supply of the computer expects, and this is kind of where our thread started on the list. So yes, the battery is DC, and yes, computers like DC, but the computer is thinking that it's going to get AC from a straight-up wall, and so the power supply still has to give the computer what it needs, and you don't have tons and tons of connections to all the peripherals inside the computer. Okie dokie. Stand by. I'm going to stop doing that.
Yeah, I was saying,
well, I'm going to make a real quick comment anyway, while Sean's standing
Hang
by.
Hang on, Conrad, go first.
No, so when you're talking about printers, I assume you mean photocopiers and probably fax machines as well?
Yes.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
Printers, yeah, vacuum definitely. Cleaners, hair dryers. Yes, believe it or not, the fact that there is a blackout is going to put your fashion plans on hold. We are not plugging the hair dryer into the UPS.
Have people actually done that?
Yes.
Must be some very vain women.
Oh, my God.
Your curling iron probably does not belong on your UPS?
No, no.
Chris, you've forgotten about my sister.
Oh, no.
That's called suppression, and that is a psychological coping technique. Let's move on.
All right, standby power supply.
Brian wants to say something.
These. Oh, yeah, I keep doing that to you. I'm sorry.
I feel the love. Anyway, we actually had, and I'm glad we put the UPS in at the office where I work, because we had, I think a couple weeks ago, somebody hit one of the power poles, and these actually give about 30 minutes, so we had enough time to shut everything down before we lost it, and it was really, really, really handy at that point.
I've actually had, when I first moved to Perth, I had 4 computers die when I first moved to Perth. And I went out and bought UPSs, and all of a sudden my computer stopped dying because the voltage was, up and down all over the place, and the UPS has actually protected my gear, and my gear has lasted a lot longer. So if you're one of those people that buys a brand spanking new laptop and wants it to run for 10 years because it's the only laptop you can possibly afford, may I suggest you put some power protection behind it?
Yes, that is probably a good idea, and I need to find one that can do 2 computers, actually.
300 or 400 volt amps will be enough. You don't need that much.
Okay.
Like.
Okay, standby power supply, or SPS, and these help protect against potential electrical power problems by providing a backup battery to supply power when the incoming voltage drops below the normal level. The battery is on standby during the normal operation. When the voltage decreases, the battery provides DC power to a power inverter, which converts it to AC power for the computer. This device is not as reliable as a UPS because of the time it takes to switch over to the battery. If the switching device fails, the battery will not be able to supply power to the computer. This makes the UPS a better choice most of the time. Because I think the UPS tries to make... It is, but I think the UPS tries to make a nice, very smooth transition from good voltage to I need to power the computer, whereas I think the SPS kind of...
No. Okay, what happens with the SPS... I'll just clarify. The SPS has a relay in it, so when the power goes off, you hear a... as the relay clicks across, and there's a fraction of a millisecond when you don't have voltage. If that relay sticks or fails, you've got nothing. The UPS actually runs the computers off the batteries at all times. So the charge is actually coming from the batteries. And when the power drops off from the charge circuit, you're still running off the batteries, so there's no transition at all. The transition is not actually present. So that's the fundamental
difference. Oh, that's right.
Difference.
Okay. Okay.
Just a continual buffer around it, I guess,
better.
Right?
Yeah, that's right. Because the load is always run off the batteries, and then the charge circuit is wired in parallel with the batteries to charge them. So as soon as you lose the power source, the inverter in an UPS runs all the time, which means UPSs are probably going to be noisier, and they're probably going to be hotter. And if you're in Australia, you're probably going to hear a whole lot of vrrr, and if you're in the States, you'll get vrrr all the time from your UPS, because you are actually running the inverter circuitry all the time.
What kind of batteries are there in there that they don't like, because a lot of batteries, will only be recharged so many times and that sort of thing. What kind of batteries are there that they can be continually charged like that?
I don't want to go too much into this, but essentially they're sealed lead acid, and basically the best way to store a sealed lead acid is to keep it completely charged. If you think about it in a car, they're not sealed lead acid, they're just lead acid. They charge up and they remain charged. So you're looking at about maybe 2, 3, maybe 5 years lifespan out of a battery if you've got a really good one. So they're basically just usually 6 or 7 amp hour bricks at 12 volts. Some UPSs use 24 volts, it just depends. But yeah, they're sealed lead acid.
Okay, cool, thanks.
Okay, many computer components, peripherals, and cleaning solutions contain materials that are hazardous to the environment, including the lead acid batteries that Carrie's just mentioned. Rules for disposing of toxic waste vary by location. Check with your state and local government for regulations in your area. A Material Safety and Data Sheet, or MSDS, is a fact sheet that summarizes information about materials material identification, including hazardous ingredients that affect personal health, fire hazards, and first aid requirements. These are likely in your test, so keep on to this information. MSDS, Material Safety Data Sheet, keeps track of all of the important stuff that you have to know to be safe around chemicals and that kind of thing.
Even McDonald's has them.
Yeah, I imagine they do. Information on an MSDS can include the following. The name of the material, the physical properties of the material, any hazardous ingredients contained in the material, reactivity data such as fire and explosion, procedures for spills or leaks, special precautions, health hazards, special protection requirements, and safe disposal procedures. So, you know, you'll see things like, if this gets in your eyes, do this and call a physician immediately. That's the kind of stuff, except in a lot more detail, I imagine, that you'd find on these things.
Did anyone see that thing the other day that was
a giant warning label?
Did anyone see that thing the other day that was bouncing around where the woman had a kid that ate ants, and then she fed the kid some ant killer, and it wasn't until she explained that they said, yes, now you've got to rush the kids directly to poisons right now.
Wow.
Like, the kid should have been okay with eating the ants if she hadn't fed it the ant killer.
Oh. Wow.
Yeah. Fantastic.
Yeah.
The common sense of some people is just
amazing.
Shouldn't there be an IQ
absolutely.
Test before breeding? I don't know.
Totally.
Or a license
dumb.
Or something. Yeah, I've often wondered this, actually. But moving right along.
Common sense.
In the U.S.,
so
exactly.
You read my mind, actually. I'd actually withheld from saying that.
Sorry, another story about lacking common sense. Whether this is true or not, I don't know, but I've seen from various sources that 9 Australians die each year from testing 9-volt batteries on their tongue, just while we're talking about hazardous materials. I've seen this in 2 or 3 different places, so I don't know.
I'm not sure how you'd die from
That's
that,
not true, because I've been doing it for about 35 years, and I'm still alive. You know? Ow. I'm still here.
You haven't done it wrong yet, Kerry.
9 volts is not going to kill you unless you have some kind of unbelievable heart problem.
That's like the fact that women swallow 6 pounds of lipstick. It's not true. But we'll see if we can find a debunker that for you.
Snopes. We'll have a look on
Snopes. Yeah. Somebody do that. Because I don't really think that one is
No, that doesn't quite seem right. Okay.
I'm Googling as we speak. Continue.
Fantastic. In the U.S., the Occupational Safety and Health Administration, or OSHA, O-S-H-A, requires that hazardous materials come with an MSDS and that employees are informed that materials they are working with are hazardous and provided with material safety information. Unfortunately, computers and their components don't last forever. Okay, this is a new topic, sorry. Unfortunately, computers and their components don't last forever, or they just become obsolete and things. So before we upgrade to that shiny new model that we've been dreaming about for months, we have to consider how to dispose of old computers and their peripherals in order to protect the environment. So we have to be safe about these things. We don't just chuck most things in the bin because it's easy. There's quite a few things that we have to be careful about. Batteries from portable computer systems may contain lead, cadmium, lithium, alkaline, manganese, and mercury. These metals do not decay and will remain in the environment for many years. Batteries including lithium ion, nickel cadmium, nickel metal hydride, and lead acid are subject to disposal procedures that comply with local environmental regulations. So since it is standard practice to recycle batteries as a technician, one of the things that we could do as a participation exercise, maybe not now, but just as a homework type thing, if you're curious and put it to the list, find out how to recycle a laptop battery in your area. That might be a good thing to work on. In fact, I'm surprised the laptop chapter doesn't have us do this, but that's okay. That might be a good thing to know.
There are certain places online where you can send in older batteries, and they'll give you a discount, and you get a newer battery.
Actually, yeah, I'd be a little concerned about shipping some of them. But
even if you go buy a battery for your car, they will give you a discount. I think I was even at one place where they didn't even want to give me the battery until I brought in a Core 3 playset. It was at a Sears. But they will give you a $5 discount or whatever if you bring in your old battery.
Okay.
That's pretty cool. Imagine if you took it to Batteries Plus, they could probably do something with it.
Here we are. Batteries, I have an article. That...
Okay. Oh,
the,
cool.
The Register basically tells us, and this myth was originally perpetrated due to the fact that there was a Navy sailor who was busy trying to test the resistance of his body with a multimeter powered by a 9-volt battery. However, when he stuck the probes into his fingers, he pierced the skin. Because the probes then were in his bloodstream, there was sufficient current to actually disrupt his heart. There are unfounded rumors, however, which is why the Navy doesn't give too many things that are sharp to their sailors, because obviously this can be a problem. There are, however, figures quoted that 8 people a year die in Australia. Only Australia, funnily enough. Struth! I think I'll test that 9-volt battery on my tongue. The actual amount of current in a 9-volt battery is not sufficient to kill you directly. However, there are occasionally freak circumstances where it can cause significant disruption to the nervous system, which I believe can actually cause people problems. I have there is an article. If you go death by 9-volt battery into Google, the second or third result down will be an article from the Register. Become educated if you dare. It can also disrupt pacemakers as well. So if you're ill or you're not well...
Now that makes...
Yeah, absolutely. That, don't do that.
But believe me, if 9-volt batteries actually killed you by testing them on your tongue, there'd be like thousands of dead blind people, believe me.
Yeah, I've done it before. It was good people. My brother was sighted and used to do that.
My dad used to do it.
Yeah.
Yeah, I've done it before.
Yeah,
I'm sure girls do too.
May I recommend, however, the purchase of an inexpensive talking multimeter if you are at all concerned about this possibility?
Yes, and don't poke yourself with the probes,
guys. I had a brother that used to chase me with them and tell me to stick out my tongue.
Oh
no!
That is not very nice.
No, that's my sibling.
It's not painful, it's just sort of a tingle, but still not fun.
It does actually kill taste buds, I believe.
I was only about 7.
That's a horrible!
That makes it even worse.
I wouldn't want to bathe with one, I'll just put it that way.
No, that probably wouldn't be a good idea. Batteries that you buy at a grocery store, such as AA or AAA, and that was really hard to read that in Braille and not go but anyway.
As odd.
Batteries do not have special local regulations for their disposal. Actually, I think if they're rechargeable, though, you have to be careful with them.
You do.
So they might not have regulations, but...
You can still throw them in the trash, or it's not regulated. You're not going to get fined for throwing a rechargeable AA battery in the trash.
But if you then happen to eat some fish that is then contaminated by the metal from your rechargeable battery, it will serve you right. So it probably, if you do know how to dispose of batteries correctly... Well, seriously, heavy metals are a big problem with fish and stuff, and a lot of the cadmium stuff comes from nickel-cadmium batteries that people have turfed out in the trash.
Now, don't they have a charger that'll charge regular non-rechargeable...
Yes.
Is
that
safe?
That just doesn't sound like a good idea, but apparently they have them.
It's called the Green Cell. It uses a combination of DC and pulsing AC to actually allow the rechargeability of alkali batteries. It does not work on batteries that are not alkali. May I respectfully suggest that you purchase some Enerloop or some similar batteries to that and use a proper NIMH or Enerloop charger. Enerloops are the batteries that have a shelf life of 2 years for their charge voltage.
I've never heard of that brand. I don't know if it's not here, or maybe I just don't look at my rechargeable batteries very often.
Varta Ready to Use is what they're called. You may be able to get them in the States. And basically, unlike a normal rechargeable battery that loses 20% of its shelf life in the first week of the charge cycle, these will actually hold their charge for up to 2 years and keep the voltage high.
Ooh.
So they're basically like long-lasting alkalis that you can recharge. So you can recharge those four batteries for that book port of yours and put them in your bag and use them 3 weeks later and still have plenty of charge in them.
God, I would have loved those when I did use my book port all the time. Okay. Rechargeable versions may need special recycling procedures. Check with local regulations as you would with laptop batteries. So yeah, we were just talking about that. When disposing of monitors, do not disassemble them because they contain very high voltages even after being unplugged. And this is especially true of CRTs, but even the LCD monitors you don't really want to go opening. CRTs contain glass, metal, plastics, lead, barium, and rare earth metals. Fun. According to the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency, or EPA, CRTs may contain approximately 4 pounds, or 1.8 kilograms, of lead. Dispose monitors according to environmental regulations in your area. It is important to also dispose of ink and toner cartridges from printers properly. Many ink cartridge manufacturers will refill old ink cartridges for reuse. Other companies, such as Walgreens in the States, will also refill old ink cartridges for you. At work, we take the empty toner cartridges to Staples, where they came from, and they will recycle them for us, and I think we get a discount on new ones as well, as you were talking about. So find out about that in your area. It's especially true with toner. Do-it-yourself kits and refilling cartridges are not recommended because ink can leak and damage the internals of a printer. These kits also void your printer's warranty.
There's an excellent ad campaign on this. I talk about it every year.
Yes, there is.
Epson has an ad where they're showing somebody trying to put concrete into the washing machine, and the washing machine is dying horribly, and it says, use genuine inks in your printer, or your printer will experience the fate of this washing machine. And if you want to make a printer technician curse, swear, and hate you for days to go, just tell them that you've been using refill kits in your inkjet, or that you tried refilling your own toner cartridge. You might find the repair bill just doubled.
Oh, fair enough. Never pour chemicals used to clean computers down the sink or any drain leading to the sewer system because you do not want them in your water supply. And that sounds pretty common sense, but I'm sure a lot of people do this. I've seen people do this. Always handle empty containers with care because traces of chemicals are still present. Certain containers may explode when exposed to heat because just a little bit of solution is still inside. That sounds like something particularly with aerosol cans. Those things can go bang really easily if you're not careful.
Yeah,
now we will talk about... Yeah. Now we're going to talk about tools, guys. Ensuring that you have the right tool for the task at hand makes your job easier as a technician. Knowing how to use them properly also ensures safety and efficiency. We will discuss hardware, software, and reference tools, including your own documentation that you create. And I'd like to just make a point that this is the stuff that, as blind technicians, we're going to have to be really, really particular with, because this is the stuff that sighted people think we shouldn't be doing. And so I think if we're going to be using these tools and stuff, we need to be doing it right. I don't know if that's politically incorrect thing to say, but I'm saying it anyway. I think if we're going to use these tools as blind people, we have to do it right because there's people that think we shouldn't even be doing it at all. So we want to be safe about this.
Another thing I wanted to bring up actually today, because somebody was making a point to me about this, working on computers with a dog in the room, possibly, you may actually want to put your dog on tie down when you do this. People may really want to shoot me for that comment, but somebody brought it up and was asking, what about my dog, a couple days ago?
Yeah, I would almost, that is probably what you'd want to do, because they're inquisitive little things, these doggies, and we don't want them getting too inquisitive.
Especially if you're working on high voltage gear, there's just one terrible howl and a big pop, and you're going to be a very sad individual, and I think it's better to put the dog on tie down for 15 minutes while you work on the high vault stuff, because your furry friend is very valuable to you. So it's really a case of... We actually had somebody who refused to put her dog on tie down, and it wasn't until we painted it to her in that particular way that she decided that it may be worth it.
Okay.
The other thing is,
I was trying to figure out why you were getting so graphic about it, but now I understand.
Because we have people who hate putting their dogs on tie down. The other thing that can happen is if you're working with a screwdriver and your dog decides to come up and nuzzle your hand, it might actually startle you, and you might punch a hole in your motherboard.
Or you.
Whoa. Yeah, or you.
It's entirely conceivable. I mean, as some of you know, I ran my work computer for 5 months with no sides on it, because I was too lazy to cut a bar to take the power supply out. And my puppy came up and was sniffing about and put his nose in the case fan. Nothing bad happened, but he won't do it twice, and it was entirely unnecessary.
Oh my goodness!
Wow.
The other thing is, a dog's nose is very sensitive, and some of them are quite damp, and that makes them very conductible. So don't go waving 9-volt batteries around in front of your dog just to tie things together.
Yeah, nice. Tools are divided into 4 categories, which we will go through now. Antistatic tools include antistatic wrist straps and mats, which we've already talked a little bit about the wrist straps, but we'll come back to the mats in a minute. Hand tools are small tools used in computer assembly. They are available individually or in toolkits, which range in size, quality, and price.
Ah, then you should tell a story about what you got last
year. Not recommended. Yes, I will. We had a little thing, and I don't know if we're going to do anything like it this term. We might. But a couple terms ago when I was a student, we had a goal where if you got your labs done by a certain date, and you passed them all, you were in a drawing to win a, as they put it, a prize that will be helpful in your computer technician career. I was like, oh, okay, whatever. And me and some other students, we did this for ITE and Discovery, and some other students and I were in, and I won for ITE, and Grace sent me this really awesome computer toolkit that comes in this big, it looks like a CD wallet, and it's got all kinds of stuff in it. I haven't actually taken apart a computer with it. My grandmother has offered me one to take apart, and I just need to go over there and have my dad and I do it one of these times. I have used the screwdrivers to open things up and put new batteries in, though, because I always hated that I never had a screwdriver when the one thing that you had to unscrew to get 4 AA batteries in was around. But I will get to it soon, I promise, but this is really cool. It's a Belkin, and I don't think it was that expensive. It's pretty neat.
I was just looking at those online just before. There is all kinds of them. There's some that even have the vacuum, little vacuum cleaners in there and stuff too.
Yeah, this one doesn't have that, but it's got the parts. The parts organizer and the ratchety things and the sockets and wire strippers or wire cutters and all kinds of stuff in there. So let's see. So buying the cheapest one you can get is not recommended, obviously, because you get what you pay for. When you're buying a toolkit, try to buy a kit with good quality tools. Some of the hand tools include flathead screwdriver. This is used to loosen or tighten slotted screws, and they do have like a little groove on the top, and then there's the flathead screwdriver has this little blade that goes in there. Phillips head screwdriver. This is used to loosen or tighten crosshead screws. And those are kind of hard to describe, those screws. If you've examined the kind of screws that hold things together before, you probably have seen them. A Torx screwdriver. This is used to loosen or tighten screws that have a star-like depression on the top, a feature that is predominantly found in laptops. A hex driver. This is also commonly termed a nut driver, and this is used to tighten or loosen nuts in the same way a screwdriver operates on screws. Needle nose pliers. These are used to hold small parts. Wire cutters. These are used to cut and strip wires, as the name would imply. Tweezers, used to manipulate small parts and components. So does it work for people which...
Yes, I was actually going to say, if you've got loose nuts, you need a nut driver, but I was abstaining.
Yeah,
right?
Yeah. Okay. Part retriever, used to retrieve parts from locations that have limited access, or which is too small for a hand, and... the diagram actually described this really well and better than I could, even though I've seen one, because I've got one in this toolkit as well. This is a pen-like object with a spring-loaded button, which extends small legs that can grip a component. Seems like that would be a little hard for us to use, but...
I've used them.
I know they also make really, really... I know they also make really, really long ones that my dad uses when he's working on cars and stuff. Like I said, that description came from the diagram, but that's better than I could describe it. Flashlight.
That's accurate.
Used to reveal... Yeah, Josh did a very good job on that. Flashlight, used to reveal confined areas and or restricted space. Yes, you might have a sighted person working with you that you need to look at something, so you should have a flashlight somewhere, even if you're not going to use it. You should probably at least know where it is. Having the right cleaning tools will allow you to clean a computer without damaging it. We will talk more about this in Chapter 4, but here's a list of some appropriate cleaning tools. Soft cloth, used to clean different computer components without scratching or leaving debris. Compressed air, used to blow away dust and debris from different computer parts without touching the components. Cable ties, used to bundle cables neatly inside and outside of a computer to avoid clutter. Parts organizer, this is a system or compartmentalizing for compartmentalizing components, enabling a technician to locate them quickly and easily, to locate the required components easily. The one I have looks sort of like a pillbox. And if you don't have a screw organizer, you could use a pillbox, I suppose.
Yeah, that'll work. You got like 7 compartments and everything.
Yeah, and some of them even have, like some of the really big ones even have like morning, afternoon, evening, night. So you got 4 little doors and 7 days. So you could use a lot of, you could put a lot of screws in there.
May I suggest, however, ones you buy from the hardware store tend to be cheaper than pillboxes. So if you have Bunnings or whatever, you can go and get one of these things that's got like 30 different compartments.
HQ, I don't know if HQ's still around, but yeah, your local hardware store. The last category.
Very interesting.
Yep.
Usually the ones that I've experienced have wires.
All right, hang on.
Hang on. Okay, Dana goes first.
It's very interesting. The notes actually say you should write it on tape or something and stick it onto the container. I don't think that's going to work for people that are blind.
Yeah, I know.
No, I don't think so.
I sort of laughed a little bit when they were very specific in the lab about what you should even write on the masking tape.
Because you can't think at all for yourself, can you?
No, not
trust me, I've seen some of the students that go through these courses, and this is so very true. They can't think for themselves, and that's why this is in the curriculum, because some of them will go, well, I don't need the masking tape. I'll just, like, permanent marker directly onto the box, and then they wonder why it rubs off. So you do have to sort of be...
I hadn't even thought about that.
No!
I would recommend... if you can, perhaps, and you've got the technology, barcode stickers, QR code stickers if you're vision impaired.
Pen friend.
Otherwise, demo.
Pen friend.
Pen friend, although keep pen in mind that the pen friend labels are not are waterproof. Dymo tape is okay, except it has a habit of falling off and scraping off. It's the glue.
Well, how long
are
you going to use this for a cup of screws?
It depends on. I've had some of my screw boxes for the past 5 years.
You must have used screws as well.
Or the dielectric never comes off.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, how many screws does Carrie have left? Sorry.
Certainly a few less than when I started working at this place.
Absolutely. Aiden, you had something to say?
I was going to say you did. That for independent, I think Independent Living Aid sells a pill box with like 7 individual things that are nicely brailled. Might be an idea for someone to suggest they make a brailled screw organizer. Also,
Walgreens.
Fair enough. Yeah,
Walgreens does that.
Oh, that's interesting. A brailled one?
Yep. As every day of the week on there.
A lot of them are braille standard. Wow. Not all of them, but more and more of them. And the other thing they're doing is when they have morning, afternoon, evening, night, they're putting A, B, C, D on them.
Oh, interesting.
My mom has one like that where each day pops out, and then there's 4 compartments for each time during the day. Some medications are very specific.
Wow. The only braille I've seen on mainstream products is a set of headphones with left and right labeled, and the store guy goes, oh, that's great, because only you can feel it, because only you would need it. I'm like, okay, cool.
My Sennheiser has a little L-looking thing. Okay.
Yeah, that's actually mandated in Europe.
Interesting.
Really?
Also, I was going to say about cable ties, the ones that I've experienced are twist ties, basically paper or plastic loaded with wire. Would that be safe to have inside computers?
No, I'd use the plastic ones or
they
the ones that are made of a nylon.
Yeah, I think they make some that are for inside computers. Awesome phone ring, by the way. The last category of hardware tools is diagnostic tools. A digital multimeter is used to check electrical connections for computer components. And you can buy talking multimeters. Do some research because they're getting a little hard to find in some instances.
I just
a loopback adapter. Oh,
yeah. I was just gonna say before I started this class, I bought one. I don't know, about a year or so ago, and I thought, well, I had lost, and I thought, man, I have to buy another one. And I went out and tried to find one, and I got on a list too, and some people gave me suggestions, and every one of the links that they told me was no longer were no longer being sold, and they have a problem selling that stuff to blind people because they think we shouldn't be doing this, which I guess I shouldn't have wired 2 houses myself, so we shouldn't be playing with electricity.
And one of them actually came out and said that.
Yeah,
one of the manufacturers actually came out and said that.
Yeah, they did, and I was kind of freaking out because I didn't think I was going to get one. I happened to find mine, which is really good because now I have it. But that
lucky.
Yeah, if you don't have one,
eBay.
You, start
you can find
now.
Them on eBay.
I looked on eBay. I didn't see them there.
They're on the Australian eBay, or at least they were a couple of years ago when Grace looked.
They
She'd
were.
Have to have another look. But yeah, no,
sometimes
there was
they're
actually.
They're called digital multimeters. Sometimes they're called voltmeters because people just call them that generically. There's different. You want to try playing with your search queries a little bit, I guess.
Yeah, I tried. Actually, the one I got was out of Canada when I had gotten it. I think. But yeah, they are harder to find now than they were even maybe a year ago. So.
Okay, a loopback adapter is used to test if ports are functioning properly. And what do these look like, Carrie? I can't remember.
They look like on one side they've got a serial or a parallel connector that's usually the inverse gender to the actual port that it's plugging into. And then the other side is just sort of all blocked off, and it actually just loops the things back inside it. And as far as I recollect, this is actually in your final. There was a question in the final about what you use to test serial
maybe not
ports
in the new one.
Ports. No, this was the new.
No,
I think we saw a
one.
Question in the new one.
Oh,
there was
okay.
Something on loop back plugs. All right,
so looping back, those aren't the ones that have lights, are they? That's a cable tester.
That's a breakout box. The serial ones are breakout boxes. Yeah.
There you go. Thanks. Now we're going to talk about software tools used to maintain and diagnose PCs, disk management tools, and these software tools, especially the disk management ones, are in your test. So be paying attention here. Disk management tools help detect and correct disk errors, prepare a disk for data storage, and remove unwanted files. Can anyone name a disk management program or a disk management tool?
Disk cleanup?
MyDefrag. MyDefrag
is correct.
Good, good. Any more?
Scan the...
Which is jumping in place with check disk, because scan disk is gone from Windows, what's it, Jigger? 7, it's all check disk again. So we went check disk, then we went scan disk, then we went back to check disk. Isn't that cool?
Does anyone remember how... Oh, I remember how scared I was when my dad and I first were using Windows 95 and we got beep! Scan disk needs to check, or whatever it says, and they made it all scary because of the wording and the big beep. I don't know who remembers that, but I sure do.
I do. The other thing is that people who... You'll notice now that if you're running Windows 7 and you happen to be one of the compulsive thumb drive reefers that just can't be bothered with your system tray and safely eject, that Windows 7 will now complain bitterly at you when you plug it back in, going, you didn't unplug this properly, we should really check this, are you sure? And then I bet you half of you go, no! And then when it happens to be the assignment you want to hand in that's corrupted on your thumb drive, well, what can I say?
Does it complain bitterly at you when you take it out? That's what it really should do, too, like the Mac does. The Mac makes you feel guilty forever even thinking about it. for me.
It sort of goes, da-dunk, and it sort of pops up a balloon saying, this device was not safely ejected, you may have had data loss. And then if there's actually data in the write cache, it screams even louder. And believe
then you
me,
get
I've actually...
delayed write failed, yes.
Yeah, and that's not a good message to see.
Mm-mm. Okay, so yes, the answers you guys are, you got good ones. FDisk or disk management is another one. We're going to list them now. FDisk or disk management creates and deletes partitions on a hard drive. Format, this prepares a hard drive to store information. Scan disk or CHKDSK, as we discussed, checks the integrity of files and folders on a hard drive by scanning the file system. These tools may also check the disk surface for physical errors. Defrag optimizes space on a hard drive to allow faster access to programs and data. Disk cleanup clears space on a hard drive by searching for files that can be safely deleted. Disk management initializes disks, creates partitions, and formats partitions. You'll have fun with this one in Chapter 12, I can tell you. System File Checker, or SFC, scans the operating system's critical files and replaces any files that are corrupted. I've never actually used this one.
SFC, yeah, I have. It does work. One of the other things I was going to very quickly point out, and this is something that a lot of people don't think about, if you are going to check disk a large volume of music slash video slash something else that is all on your precious external hard drive that you trust with your life and all of your data, make sure you shut your virus scanner down and that things aren't going to access the drive while you're check disking it, otherwise it will restart over and over and over again. I actually find that it's actually far quicker to do the command line check disk on a drive than to do the GUI one, but I am told the GUI one does work and YMMV, but do try and avoid things from accessing the drive while you're check disking it. Otherwise, Windows will just restart it at 0% again.
I've heard on some sites that file system checker is the last thing that you should try unless you want to reformat and start over. Is that true?
It is. There is actually a reason for this. If you run System File Checker on a version of Windows that is the same service pack as your install media, it's fine. But if you install Windows and then apply a service pack on top of that, and then you run, say for example, you've got Windows 7 and you've applied Service Pack 1, and you run System File Checker against the original install disk, it will then fail to match all the file checksums and try and put some of the pre-SP1 files back on your machine, hosing it. So it's very important that the media that you are system file checkering against matches the service pack of the operating system you actually have installed, which means if you want to run Windows 7 Service Pack 1, you need to have installed from a copy of the operating system that has had Service Pack 1 slipstreamed inside it. So be careful of that.
So yeah, other than slipstreaming...
Like fun.
Other than slipstreaming, there's no other way of keeping the system file checker up to date?
I'm not 100% sure of that. I would have to do more research, but my understanding is that if you have applied a service pack since you've run the system file checker, it may not be safe to run the system file checker against your current system, especially if the ISO you're going to check it against is going to be one that predates the service pack you currently have installed. I would say a search on Microsoft.com for system file checker will answer your questions, and I'd say it will answer my questions when I go and have a look later today.
Okay. The Windows XP boot disk is another one they talk about. It is designed to repair Windows system files, restore damaged or lost files, and reinstall the operating system. This method is completely inaccessible to us unless you happen to have, well, not entirely, unless you happen to have a hardware synthesizer and ASAP around and stuff and really can be bothered trying to get that to go. But for most people that don't have really old stuff, it's not going to work very well. There are tons of third-party software applications that will help you troubleshoot problems. And I want to talk about BellArc Advisor really quickly. This is BellArc Advisor, and it usually comes up on the list and stuff. Grace or Carrie, if you want to write the website in the chat, that would be good. BellArc Advisor is an excellent tool to find out all sorts of information about your PC. It basically brings up an HTML page in your browser with a report which includes hardware configuration, software license keys, and some driver information. And hint, hint, BIOS version 2. Yes, Spexy is another one.
BellArc Advisor is
really easy.
BellArc Advisor is really easy, but it is not free for use in a commercial environment. So don't use it unless you are in a home environment. You are breaking the license agreement. Just be aware of that.
Another really good one is CPU-Z, but you have to be friendly with a JAWS cursor or something of that nature.
I think with Specky as well, you have to, or Spexy, I think you have to be proficient in
actually Specky
use of the JAWS cursor.
Spexy, you can actually export to a text file and be able to read it, and that works very, very well. It gives a lot more detail. The other advantage with Spexy is that it's portable, so you can have it on a removable media. You don't have to install it. Whereas BellArc, when I used it, you had to install, and that was a nuisance actually because you might be working on someone else's machine.
I actually use one. It's called Unknown Device Identifier. I don't know where you can find it. It's HunterSoft is the company that makes it. And you can export that to a text file. It'll give you all your hardware stuff, but it won't give you the software licensing. But it'll give you all your hardware devices. All the nice little driver information. If you ever need to reload drivers for them, you can go hunt them down that way.
That's pretty cool, man.
Now, do any of these really kind of look at the memory, and can they give you a information about the memory that you can put to text?
BellArc looks at the memory, but to actually test the memory, I'd be using the standalone memory tester from there's a memtest86.org. And that comes off a boot disk, and if you actually compile up your own version with a Linux system, you can actually configure it to beep whenever a memory area is detected. So you boot the disk up, and then if your computer starts going beep 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 beep, you've got terrible memory problems. However, if you do not have a PC speaker connected, you may need to borrow a sighted person to look at the screen, unless of course you are techie enough to recompile the memtest image to use serial port output, which I don't think people would be really up for. But if anybody wants a version compiled with beep support, I can probably stick one of those up on Kavi. But if you don't have a PC speaker, it won't help you.
That might not be a bad idea, actually, if you can be bothered. That sounds like it could be useful. Malicious software, such as viruses and spyware, are a part of life for a computer component. Actually, that call's coming in, so Grace, if you could sort of take over a little bit.
All right. We are going to talk about malicious software. Sometime in your technician life, you will have to deal with malicious software such as viruses, spyware, malware, all of that good stuff. And as an extra special bonus, now you'll have to deal with people who are calling scamming you and trying to get you to install said malware, spyware, and
only
viruses.
Sometimes?
Oh, yeah, fair enough. It's okay. Yeah. Well, I know you do. If you are who I think you are,
fantastic.
Is he okay?
What happened? Yeah, I didn't stay keyed up for all that, did I?
No.
Oh, well, actually, no. He's stuck at an airport. I don't know which one. I don't know what happened. We're gonna chat later, but. I think he'll be back here. He'll be able to make it back here tomorrow evening, but I don't know what happened, so I'll find out from him.
You could have just found out now, because Bryce could handle the virus thing.
Well, no, his food was showing up, so he had to go anyway. Okay. They were banging on his door with food. So, I was going to try and find out more, but...
Okay.
So I'm just basically saying that you have to deal with it.
Yeah, you got to deal with sort of, you know, malware, spyware, all that sort of stuff, and we're talking about the junk files calls that people have been receiving multiple ones of that we spoke about last year.
Yes. That's right. So, if they have viruses, they can suffer from data loss, theft, poor performance, and failure, and you probably mentioned that. The following is a list of protection tools to help prevent infection and remove malicious software. Windows XP Security Center checks the status of essential security settings. The Security Center continuously checks to make sure that the software firewall and antivirus programs are running. It also ensures that automatic updates are set to download and install automatically. May I also add in personal comments that Security Center, for those of us who actually know what we're doing, is really, really, really annoying.
That's why you stopped the service.
Oh, my goodness. It is the worst.
Yes, it's quite fun. There's actually a way to do it without doing it that way. There is a change how XP alert, or how Security Center alerts me, but it's really hard to find.
Yeah. You jealous cursor up there, you can find that until just not to annoy you about anything, and then it just disappears.
I used to tell it I had my own firewall and antivirus and stuff, even if I didn't. That works too. Just tell it I have something that you don't know about, and I'll monitor it.
The other way is to go to administrative tools and actually just disable the dumb thing.
Yeah, that's what Carrie was mentioning too. But yeah, that's the geekier way, but it also is quicker. Antivirus program protects against virus attacks. Spyware Remover protects against software that sends information about web surfing habits to an attacker. Spyware can be installed without the knowledge or consent of the user. Spyware is fun. I think most of us know about that, and we'll talk more about that in Chapter 9. Firewall Program runs continuously to protect against unauthorized communications to and from your computer. The final set of tools you have are organizational and reference tools. Whenever you perform maintenance on a computer, you must document it properly. If you work for a company, you may have certain forms for you to document work and a place for you to store them, or store documentation so that other technicians can refer to it. If you are on your own, I'd suggest keeping a copy on a service such as LiveJournal for safe storage and easy reference. You will always remember the very first repair job you do. You may even clearly remember the first 5 or 10. After that, everything will start to sort of blend together, and you won't be remembering. Kind of like my case notes at work. They blur together, too. And what did I do last week? Documentation allows you to quickly look up solutions to problems you have already encountered before, or already encountered but can't quite remember how to fix them. As you go through the repair and troubleshooting process, keep notes about configuration changes, the things you try, and the solutions to the problem, and also the ones that don't work too. It might also be a good idea to note what didn't work. When you are done, put the following items into your technician's journal. And they use that phrase, technician's journal, a lot. Description of the problem, possible solutions that have been attempted, and the steps taken to repair the problem. Be sure to note any configuration changes made to the equipment and any replacement parts used in the repair. And this noting the configuration changes is good, because if you need to reverse them, then you'll know what you did. And I've done this before where I've changed a couple things, and then, oh, well, how did I do it, and what order did I do it in? So taking notes is a good idea. If this is a computer that you do quite a bit of work on, or you are working with other technicians, keeping a detailed history of all service and repairs is also a good idea. You have many internet references at your disposal. Can anyone name an internet resource that you can use?
Google.
That's no. Right.
Wikipedia.
Or internet search engines, I guess you'd say.
Oh, are you after search engines? Because I would say Google is a meta resource.
Yeah, search engines.
It helps you look for other resources.
Yeah, I'm just...
Yeah, we just had a comment here that somebody uses Google for everything. That's a bit dangerous, actually, because there are other search engines and other ways of finding things. And Google does tend to... I think Dogpile still exists, and it searches a multitude of search engines.
I've heard Bing is actually not too bad either.
Yeah, and Bing's got Quitter support, which is kind of cool. You can do Bing searches in Quitter if you're into that. But I have tended to find that Google is a good starting point. However, you will find that if you use a different search engine, you'll often see a completely different set of results than you would have seen just by Googling everything. It is a nasty habit to get into. As soon as you sort of go, I'm not coping, Google. Ah, my wife's left me, Google. No, Google is not the answer to all your problems.
No, especially that one.
I was saying Wikipedia or the manufacturer's website.
Those are good ones. Those are good ones.
Absolutely.
News groups are also good. FAQs. And online manuals. And sometimes forums and chats, if you can figure them out. You will learn which tools you will need for each job with experience. A working computer is a great tool to have with you for researching problems, downloading drivers, and communicating with other technicians. You might also bring some known good replacement parts. This assumes you have internet where the repair needs to happen, and if you don't, a cellular modem or dongle might be a good investment if you're going to. Now, that's one I've never heard of. Driver Magician, what's that do? I mean, I have an idea, but...
It allows you to just update your drivers and so on without having to search around for drivers.
Okay, we use Driver
Agent.
Okay,
is it similar to Driver Agent?
Yeah.
I imagine they're similar. So now we're going to talk about proper use of the tools that we've been talking about. And this is particularly focused on the hardware and cleaning tools. Knowing how to use these properly prevents injury and makes sure that you complete the repair as efficiently as possible and effectively as possible. It is important to make sure your tools are in good shape and working properly before you start to work. If you find problems, replace the faulty tool before working. That's important. As discussed previously, an example of ESD is the small shock that you receive when you walk across a room with carpet and touch a doorknob. Although the small shock is harmless to you, the same electrical charge passing from you to a computer can damage its components.
You listening to this, Drew?
Wearing an antistatic wrist strap can prevent ESD damage to computer components. The purpose of an antistatic wrist strap is to equalize the electrical charge between you and the equipment. The antistatic wrist strap is a conductor that connects your body to the equipment that you are working on. When static electricity builds up in your body, the connection made by the wrist strap to the equipment or ground channels the electricity through the wire that connects to the strap. The wrist strap has two parts and is easy to wear. Wrap the strap around your wrist and secure it using the snap or Velcro. The metal on the back of the wrist strap must remain in contact with your skin at all times. Snap the connector on the end of the wire to the wrist strap and connect the other end either to the equipment or to the same grounding point the anti-static mat is connected to if you're using one. The metal skeleton of the case is a good place to connect the wire. When connecting the wire to equipment that you are working on, choose an unpainted metal surface. A painted surface does not conduct the electricity as well as unpainted metal. I think sometimes the vent of the power supply fan is a good place. Isn't that what you were saying, Carrie?
Yeah.
And that actually makes a lot of sense, because it would kind of, there's like a little hole and everything, so it makes sense that you'd put it there. Note, attach the wire on the same side of the equipment as the arm wearing the anti-static wrist strap. This will help to keep the wire out of the way while you're working. Yes, it actually has that in here, but that does make sense. Although wearing a wrist strap will help to prevent ESD, you can further reduce the risk by not wearing clothing made of silk, polyester, or wool. These fabrics are more likely to generate a static charge. Note, technicians should roll up their sleeves, remove scarves or ties, and tuck in their shirts to prevent interference from clothing. Ensure that earrings, necklaces, and other loose jewelry are properly secured, like we talked about earlier. Maybe just don't wear them at all near the computer. You know, this isn't a fashion show. You don't need to be, you don't need to have that. Caution, never wear an anti-static wrist strap if you are repairing a monitor or a power supply unit on your test. Never wear an anti-static wrist strap when you're repairing a monitor or a power supply, because the voltage is going to cook you. There's high voltage in there, and that's not going to work very well.
Just a comment on this question on the test. There's a little bit of an English problem with this test. It says what components are actually going to you not need to wear a wrist strap for. It's a choose one question. The plural is misleading. You only want one.
It's a radio button. Pick one. That's why
yeah,
it's a radio button.
Well, some people got confused, so I have to mention it.
Well, you could pick one and then pick the other one, then pick the first one, pick the second one, pick the first
one. Oh, there's only one there.
Yeah, but there's one you think you might want.
Oh, no, there's not even one you think you might want, but if you think you need two, then you'll pick something completely different.
I thought they put two of them that would work, and they'd just sit there and make you do it.
Only one.
They didn't even put two that would work. But okay, you may not always have the option to work on a computer in a properly equipped workspace. If you can control the environment, try to set up your workspace away from carpeted areas. Carpet can cause the buildup of electrostatic charges. If you cannot avoid the carpeting, ground yourself to the unpainted portion of the case of the computer on which you are working before touching any components or carpet.
No can.
So before
does,
you...
Period.
An antistatic mat is slightly conductive. It works by drawing static electricity away from a component and transferring it safely from equipment to a grounding point. Lay the mat on the workspace next to or under the computer case. Clip the mat to the case to provide a grounded surface on which you can place parts that you remove them as you remove them from the system. Reduce the potential for ESD. Sorry, let's try this again. Reducing the potential for ESD reduces the likelihood of damage to delicate circuits or components. Note, always handle components by the edges. That just seems like a good idea. Workbench, if you have one. When you are working at a workbench, ground the workbench and the anti-static floor mat. And that would be really cool to have one of these. By standing on the mat and wearing the wrist strap, your body has the same charge as the equipment and reduces the probability of ESD. Let's talk about proper use of hand tools now. A technician needs to be able to properly use each tool in the toolkit. Someone's jaws is bleeding through slightly. You might want to be careful. Screws. Match each screw with the proper screwdriver. Place the tip of the screwdriver on the head of the screw. Turn the screwdriver clockwise to tighten or the screw, and counterclockwise, or anticlockwise as it's called most other places, to loosen the screw. Righty-tighty, lefty-loosey, if that works for
yes.
you.
Ah, yes, I was about to mention that.
Yeah.
Geraldine always
I think
came
every,
up with that
I,
one.
I think most people, I think a lot of people, I've heard that for years, I think a lot of people know that one. But in just in case you don't, you do now.
The other thing is, though, that screws that are used on wheels, like a wheel screw, or screws that are used for gas, are actually reversed to that. So just keep that in mind when you're working on the Barbie.
Wheel screw. Yeah, I guess a wheel screw would go the other way, wouldn't it? Because the wheel spins opposite to the screw, yeah. Screws can become stripped if you over-tighten them with a screwdriver. A stripped screw may get stuck in the screw hole, or it may not tighten firmly the next time. Discard stripped screws when you find them. Use a flathead screwdriver when you are working with a slotted screw. Do not use a flathead screwdriver to remove a Phillips head screw. Never use a screwdriver as a pry bar. It's not a can of paint. If you cannot remove a component, check to see if there is a clip or latch that is securing the component in place. Caution, if excessive force is needed to remove or add a component, something is probably wrong. Take a second look to make sure that you have not missed a screw or a locking clip that is holding the component in place. Refer to the device manual or diagram for additional information. So you might ask a sighted person if you're really not sure how something is situated and it's not coming out. Because if you pull it too hard, then it might break. Use a Phillips head screwdriver with crosshead screws. Do not use this type of screwdriver to puncture anything. Yeah. This will damage the head of the screwdriver. Then you won't be able to use it properly. Use a hex driver to loosen and tighten bolts that have a hexagonal or six-sided head. Hex bolts should not be over-tightened because the threads of the bolts can be stripped. Do not use a hex driver that is too large for the bolt that you are using. Yeah, that makes sense because it won't grip it and it won't turn right. Some tools are magnetized. When working around electronic devices, be sure that the tools you are using have not been magnetized. Magnetized or magnetic fields can be harmful to data stored on magnetic media. Test your tool by touching the tool with a screw. If the screw is attracted to the tool, do not use the tool. And I think Carrie and Grace take some issue with this, but if Cisco asks you, or take some liberties, but if Cisco asks you, you're not supposed to use them. So, do you guys want to
They can
talk
be
more
really
about that?
Helpful. If you are not very coordinated, they can be really, really great for holding your screw in place long enough for you to actually get it where you need it to go. But they aren't very safe to use around hard drive.
Actually, I have a very nice set of screwdrivers which actually have a screw grip on it. So you actually clip the screw into the screw grip and it holds it and you actually just tighten it in.
Cool.
Oh, that's cool.
Yeah, I saw those. Those are really handy.
Grace is all excited. I think she wants one. I want one.
Yeah, I am.
I guess something you have to be aware of, though, is when you pull a screw grip off after you've sucked the screw in its hole.
You find it a lot. You find these screw grips a lot with piano tuners because of the working on mechanisms, and that's where I actually started getting my set from.
I was
Fair
thinking
enough.
For computers,
like
you might leave some danger if you if when the screw's in its hole, if you pull the grip out, your hands are touching the surfaces more, like the motherboard more than is necessary. Possibly, I have no idea.
Isn't there a release switch or something that'll make it let go?
Yes.
Or how does that actually work? Oh, okay. So you don't touch it; you just press the button and it comes off.
It releases, yeah. And you generally start releasing it halfway once you've turned the screw in, sort of halfway, and then by then you've already got the thread, so you don't miss it.
And what did you say?
Because
you
the interesting thing is to tighten it all the way and then have the screw grip actually tightened in as well.
Oh, that's a problem.
Where did you say you normally sell those, Dana? From where did you find yours?
From a piano tuner.
Lots of piano tuning stores. I know there's stores like Goddard's and Fletcher Newman and so on in the UK. I'm not sure if you've got branches like that in Canada and the States.
Okay, thanks. Yeah, I want to look for those.
You can probably do some Googling and see. There's like piano tuning guilds and stuff. You could probably find out. The part retriever needle nose pliers and tweezers can be used to place and retrieve parts that may be hard to reach with your fingers. Do not scratch or hit any components when using these tools. Caution, pencils should not be used inside the computer to change the settings of switches or to pry off jumpers. The pencil lead can act as a conductor and may damage the computer components. That's just a really bad idea. That might not be any better. I don't know.
I was going to say, wait, what?
Took me a second to figure out.
You said it so deadpan.
The plastic stylus for PDA.
No.
Yeah, you did that really.
I'm thinking braille one.
That's kind of where I freaked out.
You probably don't want to use anything but like something that's made for that kind of job to do that, because you could poke holes in motherboards or other random things.
Can you get
plastic
pins?
What do you use for
pins?
Jumpers, Kerry?
I actually just grow fingernails and catch the tops of the jumpers between my fingernails and lift the jumpers off. Works just fine for me. And
what if you don't have nails?
Your teeth? I don't know.
No, you can't use your teeth because if you drool
on
the board...
Too conductive.
Actually, what you can do is if you gently slide a flat-bladed screwdriver under the jumper, you can actually lever it up from underneath, or you can use needle-nose pliers unless the jumpers are packed together in a block.
Yeah, that makes sense.
I think that would be very difficult on optical drive because those jumpers are so small and the pins are tiny there.
You just buy SATA drives and that's...
Tweezers? There are jumpers on SATA drives.
Yeah,
I don't have any jumpers. There are actually jumpers on SATA drives. It's just that you don't have to move them that often.
But then wouldn't that cause the same problem as a pencil? With tweezers and things being metal and stuff?
It's not going to break off.
Pencils are a problem because of the lead.
That graphite can break off in the case.
Yeah.
Oh, okay. When I joked about the stylus, I was talking about the metal braille one. But okay.
That's kind of where I freaked out.
Yeah, I would be afraid that you would actually poke a hole in your motherboard if you accidentally used that in the wrong way.
Yeah, you might actually do.
Yeah.
Or you might even scratch the copper surface of your motherboard as well.
Okay.
Well, particularly for jumpers, you might actually short your block. Like, you might bridge two...
Oh, that's true.
That aren't meant to be bridged. I don't know, I've done a lot of them, and I've always used my fingers, and I don't have long fingernails.
I guess it just is a dexterity thing. Okie dokie. We know that cleaning computers is important to maintain their working life. Dirt can cause problems with the physical operation of fans, buttons, and other mechanical components. On electrical components, an excessive buildup of dust will act like an insulator and trap the heat. This insulation will impair the ability of heat sinks and cooling fans to keep components cool, causing chips and circuits to overheat and fail. So yes, cleaning these is important. Caution, when compressed air is used to clean inside the computer, the air should be blown around the components with a minimum distance of 4 inches from the nozzle. The power supply and the fan should be cleaned from the back of the case. So before cleaning any device, turn it off and unplug the device from the power source. Let me repeat that again. Before cleaning any device, turn it off and unplug it. You'll see that a whole bunch too. And it makes sense, but not everybody thinks it
completely
makes sense.
Unplug it.
Yeah,
yes,
take it out of the wall
from
entirely.
Both sides, both ends. The wall and the back.
When you use canned dairy,
and flip the power supply
switch
if you've got
one.
Yes, we're going to talk about that. clean computer cases and the outside of monitors with a mild cleaning solution on a damp, lint-free cloth. Now, they actually tell us that we should mix 1 drop of dishwashing liquid with 4 ounces of water to create the cleaning solution. Does anyone actually do that, I wonder? I don't know, but that's what they say we should do. Theoretically, it sounds like a good idea.
Depends on the dishwashing liquid, because you've got crummy dishwashing liquid and good dishwashing liquid. And I don't know.
Well, that's what they say. If any water drips inside the case, allow enough time for the liquid to dry before powering on the computer. Yes, very good idea. Do not use ammoniated glass cleaners or any other solution on an LCD screen unless the cleaner is specifically designed for the purpose. And they have wipes and cleaners that are for LCDs. This means no Windex or similar, guys. Harsh chemicals will damage the coating on the screen. There is no glass protecting these screens, so be very gentle when cleaning them, and do not press firmly on the screen. So just be really careful. We had someone coming into the computer lab with cleaning, and I got a little paranoid and was like, please don't wipe off the screens with Windex, because of course I can't see what he's doing, but I wasn't real confident in his ability to be careful around the computer. To clean the screens of CRT monitors, dampen a soft, clean, lint-free cloth with distilled water and wipe the screen from top to bottom. And people seem to use Windex on these. That might be a little bit better than, that'd be better than using it on an LCD screen, but I don't know. I mean, still doesn't seem like I'm not sure whether that's good or not. But whatever you use, after you've used it, you then use a soft, dry cloth to wipe the screen and remove any streaking after you've cleaned the monitor. Yeah, because when you use something like Windex, it will kind of run down and streak, and you have to get rid of that. Clean dusty components with a can of compressed air. Compressed air does not cause electrostatic buildup on components. Well, there is that as well. Make sure that you are in a well-ventilated area before blowing the dust out of the computer. A best practice is to wear a dust mask to make sure that you will not breathe in the dust particles. That's great if you happen to have one, when you have one, but a lot of times you're not going to have one. Blow out the dust using short bursts from the can. Never tip the can or use the compressed air can upside down. This is because this turns the air into the kind of liquid people use in fridges and air conditioners. So you go from compressed air
to the dorm to refrigerant.
That might not be great either, though. Do not allow the fan blades to spin from the force of the compressed air. And I've seen somebody do this. You're supposed to hold the fan in place. Fan motors can be ruined from spinning when the motor is not on. And also, if you're not careful, you'll spin them backwards, and they don't like that either. And it makes a cool sound, but you're really not supposed to do that.
Now, when you're blowing,
the blades going really quickly.
When you're using compressed air to clean the fan, I'm kind of confused. Do you start from the back of the computer case, or do you go from the inside and point out with the can?
I think they want you to go from the back, but I'm not. Carrie, what do they want?
I have no idea. I'm not rich enough to have compressed air. I just get a cloth and wipe the fan down because I'm poor.
Oh, you don't? Or you just...
I've been for $14 at Big W.
Fan? Oh, that actually does the job.
Yeah.
Well, what about the power source fan and the CPU fan?
Generally speaking, you can just blow the air down onto the CPU fan and get the stuff out of the heat sink. As far as the power supply fan is concerned, maybe you just buy a new power supply, hey? It's just easier. Because honestly, if you're trying to blow air back in through the power supply, you're just going to end up blowing all of the dust back inside the metal box, and then it'll short out and go bang. So I'm kind of thinking that you're not going to clean power supply fans.
You could take it out.
But you'd have to blow it you'd have to, like, if you blew air through one of the vents of the power supply, you'd risk shifting all the dust and stuff around on the circuit board, and that would mean that you would end up with a situation where you could short the power supply
That's
out.
True. Yeah,
which would then go bang and you go get a new one.
Anyway, yeah. Well, if we're going to get a new one anywhere, I guess there's nothing to lose, but meh.
So only be concerned with the case fans and possibly the CPU?
Yeah, the case fans and the CPU fans.
Yeah.
Yeah, I would say so. Honestly, the power supply fans and stuff, you're not meant to be opening up a power supply to clean them. The best way to clean power supply fans is to open up the power supply, remove the power supply fan, use a cloth to clean the fan and sewing machine oil and blue tack. But you guys shouldn't be doing that, so let's just buy a new supply.
Alrighty. Clean the contacts on components with isopropyl alcohol. Do not use rubbing alcohol. Yes, they're very similar, but the rubbing alcohol contains impurities that can damage contacts. And some of these include liniment, so you don't want to use that. Make sure that the contacts do not collect any lint from the cloth or cotton swab that you use. Blow any lint off the contacts with compressed air before reinstallation. Clean a desktop keyboard with compressed air or a small handheld vacuum cleaner with a brush attachment designed for the purpose. Never use a standard vacuum cleaner inside a computer case. The plastic parts of the vacuum can build up static electricity and discharge to the components. Use only a vacuum approved for electronic components. We know of someone who vacuumed up parts of his laptop touchpad because he wasn't very careful with the vacuum cleaner he was using.
He was using a Dyson. And that's probably not the
that's
vacuum
the
cleaner
worst
to be using
kind
on your
you could
computer.
Use. Those things are scary. Have you seen those Dyson Airblade hand dryers too? Those are scary. You feel like it's going to rip your hand off when you stick it in there. Use glass cleaner and a soft cloth to clean the outside of the mouse. Do not spray glass cleaner directly on the mouse. Actually, that goes for any cleaner. Don't spray it on the computer component or whatever. Put it on whatever cloth you're going to use first. If cleaning a ball mouse, you can remove the ball and clean it with the glass cleaner and a soft cloth. Wipe the rollers clean that are inside the mouse with the same cloth. Do not spray any liquids inside the mouse.
Good luck finding a ball mouse.
Yeah, they're still around though. Basically, now they basically have a really quick list of computer components and their proper cleaning methods. And this is a diagram ripped straight out. They're saying that computer case and outside of the monitor should be cleaned with mild cleaning solution and a lint-free cloth. LCD screen, mild cleaning solution and a lint-free cloth. For CRT screens, mild cleaning solution and lint-free cloth. For heat sink, they say compressed air. RAM, isopropyl alcohol and lint-free swab. Keyboard, handheld vacuum cleaner with a brush attachment. Mouse, mild cleaning solution and a lint-free cloth. This concludes the material of Chapter 2, apart from the quiz, which I don't know when we'll get to the quiz, but that's
We've
Chapter
got time.
2 itself
done. Let's
do
the
do
quiz.
Do we have enough time?
There are still 7
yeah,
minutes.
Yeah, we got time. We can get through that quiz.
There are still 7 minutes?
Yeah
there
you did
are. That's correct. Alrighty. I wasn't sure. Alright. Everybody into your chat window. In your chat window. And most people probably already are. Going to give you answers. These are going to be multiple choice answers. If there's more than one choice you're supposed to pick, yes, no. And you answer in the chat when I say answer now. Here we go. Number one. What is the minimum level of electrostatic discharge that a person can normally feel? Is it A, 5 volts, B, 1,000 volts, C, 3,000 volts, or D, 10,000 volts? Answer now. The answer is C. The minimum that you can actually feel is 3,000 volts. Number two, which recommendation should be followed first when a fire in the workplace is out of control? Is it A, try to use the elevators to get to the lower floors faster? B, contact emergency services for help? C, use the company water system to stop the fire from extending to other areas? Or D, try to control the fire with proper extinguishers. Choose now.
What a stupid question. I'd be getting out of the building away from the fire and then calling the emergency service.
Yes.
Yeah, well, the
not using the elevators,
out
though.
Of control. When it's out of control, you don't do anything. You call them, you get out. As Jackie said, you get the fire truck out of there.
That works.
And then you call for help. I actually thought that was quite clever, so I borrowed it.
Or you get the that Fred works. Out and the fire truck in.
Yes, that works too. Okay. Yeah. Number 3. Which two tools are recommended for cleaning a PC? So this is choose 2. Antibacterial spray, yes or no? No is right, absolutely. I don't know where they came up with that. Compressed air, yes or no? Yes, why? Yes is correct. Mild abrasive detergent? That's a bit of an oxymoron to me. The answer is no.
They did say dishwasher.
How about...
The problem there is it said abrasive.
Mild abrasive.
Non-abrasive.
Oh, okay.
Okay, how about nylon brush?
Stuff like...
Oh, go ahead, Roy. Sorry, Brian, what were you thinking?
When they're talking about abrasive detergent, I think they're thinking about, things like, I don't know what they have in other parts of the world, but here we have this Comet stuff like, or Ajax, and it's almost gritty, and it would do nasty things, cleaning your computer with it.
Yep, fair enough. Rubbing alcohol, yes or no? Absolutely not. And soft cloth, absolutely, very good. Number 4, which type of tool should be used to remove the screw that's depicted in this graphic that they've shown me, and it is a screw with a straight slot at the top. So would we use A, stripped screwdriver, B, a flathead screwdriver, C, a hex driver, or D, a Phillips screwdriver, Phillips head screwdriver? Choose now. Absolutely right, that is a flathead screwdriver. 5. How does a technician discharge static buildup? Is it A, touching the painted part of the computer case? B, touching an unpainted part of the computer case? C, touching an anti-static wrist strap before touching any computer equipment? Hang on, I'm not done. D, touching an anti-static mat before touching any computer equipment. Okay, now answer. The answer is B. We touching an unpainted part of the computer case. And some people choose not to wear an anti-static wrist strap and just touch an unpainted part of the case. I would probably just wear the wrist strap and be done with. Just make it easier. 6. Which device is designed specifically to protect computers' electrical devices from excess electrical voltage? What is going on here? Oh, okay. There we go. A, power strip, B, standby power supply, C, surge protector, or D, uninterruptible power supply. Choose now, or do you need the question again? The answer they're looking for is a surge protector. Number 7.
Lots of power bars have surge protectors in them now.
That's what I was
Yeah, but they're
say
saying you use...
UPS.
Well, sorry, they don't have...
Carrie had mentioned that uninterruptible ones now, a lot of them have surge protectors in them too. No?
Yes, but that wasn't but uninterruptible power supply isn't one of the choices. They have power strip, standby power supply, surge protector, or uninterruptible. Oh, it was. For some reason, they have some surge protector.
Because UPS is for when the power goes out, not when there's a spike or a surge.
Yeah, that's right. It can do that. And surge is what Cisco says on the website, because we had the quiz spot checked. And surge is what Cisco wants. So.
Yeah, that would be the obvious
number
one.
7.
I thought I'd catch 2 there.
Yeah, that's fair enough. And of course, they throw power strip versus surge protector in there, too. All right, number 7. Which 3 effects can be observed on computer components as a result of climate? Choose 3. The first one, components overheat if it is too hot. Yes or no? Absolutely, yes. They overheat when they get too hot. How about the next one? Moisture damages computer parts if it is too humid. Yes or no? Absolutely. How about How about components work too slowly if it is too cold? Yes or no? Absolutely. How about the risk of ESD increases if the humidity is too low? Yes, that is correct. The risk of ESD increases if the humidity is too low. And you know what? They've got other options, but we've got our three, and you don't even want to know what these were. Number 8. Which condition refers to a sudden and dramatic increase in voltage, which is usually caused by lightning?
Is hey, this is a, on your test, brownout? Guys.
Yes. Is it A, brownout, B, sag, C, spike, or D, surge? Answer no.
Everybody picked
yes,
that one.
Yes, spike is the answer that they want. Good. Number 9. Which two devices commonly affect wireless LANs? I guess this is a choose two. It does
choose two.
Okay. How about Blu-ray players? Yes or no? Absolutely right. That is no. How about home theaters? Yep. The answer that they say is no. So you guys are correct. Wireless phones. Yes, wireless phones is correct. And how about microwaves?
Absolutely.
That's correct. And just for your amusement value, the other two options it says here is incandescent light bulbs and external hard drives.
Oh my God.
Exactly. I'm just like, you've got to be kidding me.
Actually,
if it were lights, it'd really be a problem.
I actually have a power supply on an external hard drive that when you turn the hard drive on after the supply's been running for 2 minutes, it will knock out every AM receiver within about a block of my house.
Wow.
That's special.
I actually kept the plug
but
pack
to be
because
fair,
it was
that's
so
not
specially, amazingly.
Oh, yeah,
yeah
I would have kept that
You just plug
through.
It in. Yeah, I've still got it. You just plug it in, and after about 2 minutes, it's like, brrr, across every AM radio for about a block.
Interestingly, ooh. My Mac adapter is sort of going, but it does, and it's hot, but it doesn't seem to be, like, doing anything bad, and I Googled, and I'm not the only one having this. It's in my Mac Mini. Anyway.
I was thinking that would have been great for construction workers, but lights can have an effect. I know in Dad's place, whenever he switched the kitchen light off, static went away from the radio.
Yeah, but not for wireless LANs, though.
Speaking of construction workers, we actually have a mutual friend who often comes on social who bought themselves a low-power FM transmitter and lined it up perfectly to knock out the construction people's radio.
that's where my
awesome.
Comment about your power supply would have come in.
Yeah.
But they were listening to FM crap, unfortunately.
Or you can play really offensive things through the FM transmitter at them, too, if you know what frequency Ooh. You're using. That's the other thing you could do.
Okay, do we have any more quiz left to do, by the way?
Yes, we do. Sorry. 10.
Okay.
Which two computer components can contain very high voltages? How about DVD-ROM? Yes or no? That's correct. No. How about monitor? Okay, how about printer? Actually, no, it doesn't say printer here. Sorry, it says power supply. Sorry.
It's still a yes.
But it's still a yes either way. Okay, and that's our two. So that is the end of our quiz and the end of chapter 2.